Welcome to the 10:30 docket at the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is, to my right, Justice Bob McCoy. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofino. We have finished our 9 o'clock docket and are now beginning our 10:30 docket. We have one case set for oral submission on the 10:30 docket. Our other case is submitted on briefs. I understand both sides are ready, so if you'll call the case, please.
The court will now call Momentos versus the state, and may it please the court, Mr. Richard Lee Griffin to argue for the appellant and representing the state, Ms. Lisa Callahan to go first for 10 minutes, and Ms. Andy Porter will argue for 5 minutes.
Richard.
May it please the court. The appellant argues that the conviction for interference with the police officer engaged in his lawful duties and that the conviction for blocking a public sidewalk should be reversed and an order of acquittal entered because there is insufficient evidence to show that the sidewalk was blocked. In summary of what is set out in detail in the brief and is found in the record is that the only evidence that could be construed to support the conviction is the officer's answer to some leading questions, testifying to his opinion that the sidewalk was being blocked. But the officer, who was the only witness in the entire trial, when cross-examined, testified specifically that there was 10 to 12 feet clear on the sidewalk between where the tents were and the park, and that people were moving up and down the sidewalk at the time. The evidence is clear that there was no blocking the sidewalk.
Wasn't that for the jury to decide? I mean, you say these were leading questions, but there was no objection that they were leading questions, so we're not going to follow that rabbit trail with you, I don't think.
Well, I'm not taking you down that rabbit trail, Your Honor. I'm not saying that that they should have not been admitted because there was no objection and they're in the record.
Okay, but the officer clearly testified in the affirmative to those questions. Therefore, the jury heard that. They heard the other testimony concerning that there was enough room to move, and it was their decision. Aren't you asking us to substitute our judgment for the jury's judgment in this particular instance?
No, Your Honor. I'm asking you to review the evidence to see if it was legally sufficient to support the jury's decision. And my argument is that the evidence you've just summarized is not legally sufficient. His very detailed testimony showed there was no blockage, and a conviction based on that testimony is not supported by the evidence.
Are there any photographs or sketches of the setup there that night?
There are some photographs. I don't know how clear they are. I cited them in the brief. Mm-hmm. They're exhibits 1 and 2 mm-hmm. in the record that do show that area. I can't remember. I don't think I have those photographs with me for sure, but I did cite those for this point.
But they're not attached to the brief
as an
exhibit or anything.
No, they're not. And actually, the ones I had were very hard to see. They were black and white.
Well, that combined with the officer's testimony would be evidence for the jury. So is your question maybe the vagueness of the statute? What constitutes blocking?
Well, that is part of my argument in the First Amendment part of the case. Not that the statute is necessarily broad on its face or invalid on its face, but that when you're considering the effect of a criminal statute on especially something like trespass or interfering or blocking a sidewalk, at that point when you're deciding that question, you have to weigh not just is the statute violated, but you have to weigh the impingement on the First Amendment rights against the harm you know, that the statute is protected against it. Against, it's very a fact-specific kind of thing. And I think in this case, given the evidence of the sidewalks, that on the constitutional question, this conviction violates the First Amendment and should be reversed for that reason.
Where is that? I'm reading your 2 points under argument.
Oh, well, I have a, I was responding to the court's question primarily. My point on the free speech guarantee is in point three of my argument, which is summarized on page 7 and discussed more fully in the argument itself. So I've raised the point in the brief. And in a related matter, the question is the evidence for the interference claim sufficient? Because it's part of the element of the case that the lawful duty has to be lawful. And the evidence was insufficient there. In fact, the evidence was that there should never have been an order to vacate the tents and to move them. So for that reason, the evidence is insufficient for that count of the indictment or information. Just want to mention the jury charge, where there is a, it's an element of the offense that the interference with a police officer not be speech only. Only cases I can find construing that involve where people were uttering things from their mouths. But I think that the purpose of that requirement is to protect that crime that in the criminal code, that offense, from being found constitutionally impermissible because it could restrict free speech. So speech only should not be limited to oral utterances by the accused. It could be resistance as any form of protected speech. And of course, this doesn't mean violence. It doesn't mean anything like that.
So if they had parked a tank out there on that sidewalk and put their signs on it, that would be protected? That wouldn't be interference, or that wouldn't be obstructing a sidewalk?
I think a tank would have blocked the entire sidewalk. Nobody could get across it. Whether it was, since I mean, that wasn't the case, that would be a different case. It certainly would be an obstruction.
What about interference? Because that's what you were arguing, and that's what I was directing my question to.
Okay. In that case, I think the officer would have a lawful duty to clear the sidewalk. And so there would be interference if the people refused.
So where do we draw the line?
Line
between a tent and a tank?
Well, that's where you draw the line. For one thing, we don't have to draw it any closer right now. You know, this is the case that we have, and these are the facts we have. If I ever have a client who puts a tank on a sidewalk, I'll be in a tougher spot. These are pretty peaceful people.
Well, where do we draw the line if we say that a failure to obey a police officer's order is free speech? Put the gun down. No, free speech. Now, that's one extreme. Where's that line drawn?
Well, certainly not at that end. I mean, that's well short of that end. Anything that I think that will create a risk of violence would not have the protection that I'm talking about. You know, there was, in the old jurisprudence, there was some, I mean, maybe a century ago, there was some authority that you could resist an unlawful order with any force you wanted. And we've gotten well beyond that in a more civilized society where even if their order is unlawful, if it's going to take violence to resist it, you don't do it. And so we don't even have to worry about that, I don't think, in this case. I don't think a reversal in the case would, you know, threaten the jurisprudence we have or the civility we have in these cases. You know, I just don't think it would.
So you're suggesting that a defense to not responding to an officer's order to you is free speech?
No, but if it is free speech, then it's not this offense. Maybe there's some other offense, but it's not interfering with a police officer, because part of the offense is that the interference is not speech only. So other forms of interference are not free speech, but if the interference, if the alleged interference is free speech, then it's not interference. It's not even a defense that the defendant has to prove. They've put it in as an element for the state to prove. So, and I think the jury charge under the evidence of the officer should have been submitted for that reason. And on that ground, I'm going to ask for a new trial on the jury charge question.
Would you tell us the jury charge? What jury charge are you talking about?
Talking about the jury charge on interference with a police officer performing his lawful duties.
Mm-hmm.
The defense objected to the charge because it did not charge the jury on the question of whether the interference was free speech, which is part of the statute.
And the state objected that that would have been a comment on the evidence?
I think they did. Yes. The judge overruled the defendant's objection to the charge. It did not charge the jury on that.
You thought you were entitled to the jury instruction because the statute includes the free speech reference?
That's half of it, and because the officer testified. The officer testified that, first of all, that the tents had signs on them expressing political sentiment, that the defendant, when questioned, said that this tent was his free speech expression, and the officer testified that the signs on the tents were exercises of First Amendment rights. So,
but did the charge track the charging instrument?
Yes, it did, I think. I didn't see that it did not track the charging instrument.
Which tracks the statute.
I'll have to look. I'll try to look before rebuttal.
Or the ordinance, I guess it would be. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
That's great. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Lisa? How does a police officer know that somebody is violating this ordinance if it says it's unlawful to enclose, build upon, or make any other private use of any part of the street, sidewalk, or other right-of-way, when at election time people will park the car on the curb, decorate it with signs, will park across from a polling place, decorate the car with signs, and nobody is going to be able to park in that spot. Nobody is going to be able to drive in that spot, even though it may be a lawful parking place. How does the officer know when somebody is violating this municipal ordinance? Don't people do it all the time? Lemonade stands.
I would imagine that people do it quite regularly. I can imagine that in that situation an officer might look at whether or not the space was being used specifically for its intended purpose. The car, for example, would be properly parked. What was on the car would be a separate issue. With regard to the sidewalk, a sidewalk is not generally a camping ground or someplace that is generally used for the erection of tents. And in fact, if there's testimony in this case in the record which specifically indicates that people were having to go around it in order to use the sidewalk for its appropriate purpose, that would be part of the criteria I'm presuming that a police officer would look at in enforcing that statute.
And the lemonade stand and the person standing holding a sign, if you're standing holding a sign, you are taking up space. People can't walk there.
But not erecting a structure. I would imagine that building a lemonade stand, as it is for a private purpose, obviously, would be subject to the same restriction as the tents in this case. An individual standing, though, standing is part of the proper purpose of a sidewalk, and presumably that would be permitted. May it please the court, opposing counsel, co-counsel, I am going to use the first 10 minutes of my argument to address appellant's first, second, and fifth issues, which have to do with evidentiary sufficiency. With regard to 1 and 2, they have challenged the evidentiary sufficiency of both of the convictions. Now, with regard to the interfering case, the elements of the hypothetically correct jury charge are as follows: that the appellant with criminal negligence interrupted, disrupted, impeded, or interfered with Peace Officer D. Young as D. Young was removing a tent from the public sidewalk. Now, specifically, the appellant is identified, and I'm referring to Volume 3 of the record, is identified on page 37. Criminal negligence is proved up on page 40. Specifically, they actually proved intentional and knowingly. They went to a higher standard than criminal negligence, but that was the element of the offense. Interrupted, disrupted, impeded, or interfered, that is proved up on page 40 and 41. With Peace Officer D. Young, he identifies himself on page 13. And as D. Young was removing a tent from the public sidewalk, that is proved up on page 42. So each of these elements are specifically proven in the record. And additionally, States Exhibit 1 at minute markers 30 through 34, 19 through 26, and 2 through 3 inclusive, also prove up each of those elements. With regard to the obstructing the sidewalk, essentially pages 38, 37, and 38 prove up the element of the appellant acting alone as or as a party, page 38, intentionally or knowingly, page 38, obstructed, page 38, a public sidewalk located in the 800 block of Lamar Street, pages 29 and 38, and then by setting up a tent on the sidewalk, page 38. Also, at minute markers 2 and 3 on States Exhibit 1, you can physically see the tent, and you can hear Mr. Momentoff in there, who is engaging in conduct, first of all, by having erected the tent, then, of course, he's sitting in the tent, then, of course, he's refusing to be obedient to the direction or instruction of the officer, and that's all visible directly in States Exhibit 1 at minute markers 2 to 3. Additionally, with regard to Issue 5, the appellant claims that Mr. Momentoff was not properly identified in the record. What page 37 of the record in Volume 3 reflects is that the officer specifically pointed to the appellant in the courtroom, described him, where he was sitting, and a color of his shirt, and that the prosecutor in that case asked that the record reflect that the witness has identified the defendant. Additionally, the defendant was also in States Exhibit 1 identified by a driver's license, by name, and of course that was the name that he was convicted under in the jury charge. There was no objection at trial and no assertion in the record anywhere from counsel for the defense that the wrong person had been identified or that the defendant had in any way been misidentified. That being the case, under Rawling v. State, the state's position would be that he was properly identified.
Any questions?
Thank you. Well, at this time, for these reasons, I would ask the court to overrule these points of error and affirm the trial court's ruling. And at this time, I will sit down and my co-counsel will speak as to the third and fourth issues. Thank you very much.
Give Andy the rest of Lisa's time, too, would you?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please
the court. Wait till the clock catches up. Did you ever get your hyperlinks to work?
Not yet.
January.
Yes, ma'am. May it please the court. My name is Andy Porter, and I'll be addressing issues 3 and 4. The easy answer to issue number 3, and I apologize for not citing it in the state's brief, is Duncantell, D-U-N-C-A-N-T-E-L-L versus State. That's 230 Southwest 3rd, 835, specifically at pages 843 through 44. That's a Houston 14th opinion issued in 2007, and petition was refused in that case.
But haven't they said since you can go to issues, you can brief reasonably broad issues now? How does that affect multifariousness?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Well,
I apologize.
This is the multifarious issue, right? Your argument is that it's multifarious.
Yes, ma'am.
But the rules have changed, and you're allowed to argue issues that may have more than one subpart to them.
Yes, ma'am.
So does that affect the multifarious complaint?
The state's complaint about the multifariousness of the appellant's argument on issue number 3, the appellant himself, has in his reply brief, has already waived his claims under the Texas Constitution. He affirmatively wrote that, so that takes care of the multifariousness position of the state. So that's not something that the court has to worry about at this point.
Okay.
But addressing the merits, the easy answer, as I told you, is Duncantel versus State, which in which the 14th Court of Appeals addressed the constitutionality of 3015, whether it violates free speech, concluded it doesn't. That's the easy answer. The more difficult answer is determining whether or not 3815 amounts to a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction on free speech. The appellant's third issue here turns on whether or not the evidence shows his intent was communicative. That's the first part. The appellant's third issue next turns on whether the prohibition against blocking a public sidewalk constitutes a reasonable regulation. With respect to the first issue of whether or not his intent was communicative, the record is not clear on that. The record says that some, and that is important, the word is some, of the tents had signs on them. If you watch State's Exhibits 1, the videos, State's Exhibit 1 and State's Exhibit 2, very closely, you can tell which tent is Mr. Momentov's. It's the largest tent out there. The other four tents out there were much smaller, one- and two-person tents, but this was a large four-person tent. It has a domed top. And if you watch carefully on State's Exhibit 1 or 2, and you watch when the officer comes in and out of that tent, you don't see any signs on the tent. At other times, you can see side angles of both sides of the tent. You can't see any signs on there. Maybe I got a bad copy, but I watched it very carefully yesterday. I couldn't see any signs on his tent. There is no evidence in the record that there were signs specifically on his tent. You can see in State's Exhibits 1 and 2, the videos, that there are signs on other people's tents. In fact, one person went so far as writing physically on the tent. Other people duct taped signs to their tents. But there's none of that on Mr. Momentov's tent. So to the effect that he claims his tent was speech, other than his bald assertion when Sergeant Young encounters him inside the tent, there's no evidence of what that symbolic speech meant. That's never explained anywhere in the record. The appellant could have called the three other people who are inside the tent and asked that very question. What does the tent mean? How is it symbolic of your protest? What's the political message? That was never explained to the jury. So that's the first problem with his argument on issue number three, that it violates the constitutional right. There's no evidence that his tent actually conveyed a political meaning. The second problem with it goes to the fact that the government may impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions on the exercise of First Amendment right. The U.S. Supreme Court has on numerous occasions said so. United States versus O'Brien, and the most importantly, and has direct bearing on this case, is Clark versus Community for Creative Nonviolence, and that is 468 U.S. 288. 1984. You may remember this more as the Lafayette Park case. People wanted to protest or highlight the plight of the homelessness in Lafayette Park, which is across from the White House. And the U.S. Park Services denied them the permit because the protesters wanted to set up tents and sleep in the tents overnight as a form of symbolic expression of the plight of the homelessness. It's the fact of having to sleep in a tent in October under the weather in Washington, D.C. to really put out the impact that these people go through every night. And the U.S. Supreme Court said prohibiting camping in Lafayette Park was a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction for several reasons. First of all, the park regulation was content neutral. It didn't prohibit the specific type of speech. It just prohibited sleeping overnight. Second of all, it didn't prohibit any type of protected speech. It allowed alternative parks in which those same protesters could have camped overnight. So it all offered alternative avenues. And finally, it advanced an important substantial governmental interest, that being keeping the park clean, making it available to the general public who visits the park by millions every year. And the U.S. Supreme Court said the park regulation did not impact adversely the First Amendment rights of the protesters. Finally, with respect to the jury charge issue, the appellant's argument fails for several reasons. First of all, under 3815, subsection D, the statute says it is a defense to prosecution that the conduct alleged in the charging information amounted to speech only. So you first got to, in order to get that subsection D instruction, and it's the defendant's burden to point out evidence for this instruction, you have to look at the charging instrument. That's under the statute. In this case, the charging instrument specifically said that the appellant interfered with Sergeant Young's duties by refusing to evacuate the tent. So it's that manner and means, because Section 3815 is a conduct-oriented statute, so we look at the manner and means to determine the propriety or appropriateness of the jury charge under subsection D. So you look at the manner and means, refusing to evacuate the tent. So the only way the defendant would have been allowed to have a subsection D instruction under 3815 is if his refusal to evacuate the tent, that manner and means alleged in the information, amounted to speech only. That is not the case. And there is no evidence in the record that his refusal to evacuate the tent after a repeated request amounted to speech only. Absent that, he wasn't entitled to the jury instruction, and Judge Sorrells correctly ruled. When the appellant returns for rebuttal, I'd like to hear him explain where the evidence is that his refusal to evacuate the tent amounted to speech only. Absent that, he cannot prevail on the first issue. I see my time is about to expire.
I have a question, Andy.
Yes, ma'am.
There's no definition of, I'm looking for the statute again, or the ordinance again, but there's no definition of block, is there?
No, ma'am, not in the statute. I don't recall there being one, either in the interference of duties of a public servant or in the municipal ordinance. I believe it's 30-12. I don't remember there being a definition of block, but the jury was entitled to use its own common understanding of what Sergeant Young's testimony meant by the term blocking.
Well, how does a police officer know if the municipal ordinance doesn't tell him, the officer, what blocking means? Then how does the officer know? Aren't we opening the officers up to some unfortunate situations here? If there's no description of what blocking means, does it make it impossible to pass, or impede the ability to pass, or block a part of the sidewalk that nobody uses anyway?
I think under these specific facts, facts in this case, suggest that the tent completely blocked the sidewalk. That's not crystal clear. That was ultimately a decision for the jury to make.
And they saw the video.
Yes, ma'am. And to answer an earlier question, with respect to photos in the record, there are no photos in the record of the way the tents appeared at the time. The photos in the record are of Burnett Park during the daytime, not at night, and there are no tents in those pictures. For the foregoing reasons, we ask the court to overrule the appellant's five issues and affirm the trial court's judgments.
No
questions? All right, thank you. Richard?
I don't have a copy of the charge. I'm sorry for that. But the charge objection was because it didn't give the jury an instruction about that part of the offense. So it wasn't in the charge, but I don't have it to show you or tell you today exactly what it said. The something to understand you can get from reading the record is that the police officer was predicating his actions on a city code that says you can't build on a sidewalk. And through his testimony, that was where he started. But then it shifted to being blocking a sidewalk. And the offense of blocking a sidewalk is in the penal code. It wasn't a municipal offense. And is defined there as obstructing or making it unreasonably inconvenient to pass. That's the definition in the penal code.
But what was he charged with, the penal code violation or
yes.
the ordinance violation?
No, he was charged with the penal code violation. Once it got to charging, okay, he was arrested for interfering with a police officer. That's what the officer arrested him for. But the officer's decision to clear all those tents was mistaken. There is a city provision that says First Amendment activities can be conducted on a sidewalk without permitting. He didn't know about that at the time, apparently. He did testify at trial that he had read it, he understood it. So his testimony shifted throughout the trial. I do want to spend just a minute on, I really respect technical writers. I was trying to write something describing a part of a typewriter the other day, and it was just terrible. And in this case, I was trying to describe the geography from the record and from the photographs. The counsel correctly, I remember them, when he was talking about them, show the location of the tents in the street. But Burnett Park is a lovely park, and between Burnett Park and Lamar is a large sidewalk. And right next to the street, on that side of the sidewalk, there's a row of trees that line the street. This is all from the record. It's not from me going down there or being there, but it's gathered from the record, from the testimony and the photographs. The tents were not across the sidewalk. The tents were between the trees. The tents did not stick out, you know, at least not much, beyond the tree line themselves, which is why there was 10 to 12 feet, as the officer testified, the sidewalk in which people walked up and down. All right. On cross-examination, he was asked and admitted that if people tried to go from the sidewalk next to the park directly onto Lamar, they would be committing a traffic offense, popularly known as jaywalking. So there was no blocking in this case. The evidence shows there was no blocking.
Were the tents on the sidewalk?
Yes. Between
the
trees.
Could people walk where the tents were? Whether they were going to jaywalk or not, could people walk where the tents were?
Walk around the tents.
Could they walk where the tents were?
They could not walk through the tents unless they were high jumpers.
So that portion of the sidewalk was obstructed by the tent. Whether
yes.
you think it's a usable or an important or anything else, that portion of the sidewalk was obstructed by the tent.
It was. But was the sidewalk unreasonably obstructed for pedestrians? And I just think you can't conclude that it was if you read the record. I've got 1 minute. How to use it. The testimony on identification, I feel very strongly about it, although I'm not very hopeful about it. But the testimony was not as related just a few minutes ago, that the record does not show that the officer identified the appellant, which is what you were told. It says the officer was asked to see if the person was in the courtroom. He said, the man in the blue shirt at the table. That was it. There were four men at tables there, not counting the bailiff and the marshal. So I believe that's it.
Questions?
Questions?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your argument. It's an interesting issue on several levels. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business unless you just want to hang out in an empty courtroom, because this court's going to adjourn.